Shavira Manaz versus Garland. And we have, I believe, both counsel appearing by Zoom, it looks like, and they're right here in front of us. So we'll start with the petitioner. And we have 10 minutes per side. If you could let us know, counsel for the petitioner, how much time you plan to reserve for rebuttal, that'd be great.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel. You can go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. This is a review of a withholding and CAT denial, as well as a request for a remand so that the petitioner can seek cancellation of removal under INA Section 240B, A, little b. That form of relief was not available to him at the time of his hearing or at the time of his appeal to the board or at the time of his briefings to the board. It became available only afterwards, some 9 months or so, by virtue of the Lopez decision this court rendered. The IJ found the petitioner to be completely credible anyway, and the board adopted the IJ's findings. The government's position is that this court lacks jurisdiction to hear our request for a remand for cancellation of removal because it wasn't raised below. And while that's ordinarily true, we rely on the Alcaraz case for the proposition that where a change in the law occurred after the matter had been fully briefed, argued, and decided, there was no occasion to raise it below. It's essentially analogous with the futility doctrine according to the Alcaraz decision.
So, and for those reasons, do you think Pereira was a change in the law, or was there not really a change in law until Lopez?
First part, I think Lopez,
your client.
Yeah, okay. I think Lopez was the change in the law, Your Honor. And the reason is when Pereira was published, I can tell you in this community there was a lot of uncertainty about what it represented, and it didn't become.
But it's uncertain. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Like, obviously, Lopez makes it very clear. Mm-hmm. How clear does it have to be? I mean, does it just have to provide you an opening for there to be a change in the law, or does it have to be as clear as Lopez?
I think it has to be as clear as Lopez because the Pereira decision didn't touch on the jurisdiction of this court, and so that question was left open, nor did it touch on whether a subsequent notice of hearing would cure the putative NTA. And so there were a lot of loose ends and unanswered questions in the wake of Pereira that weren't decided in this circuit until Lopez. So that was the operative change that rendered him eligible. He wasn't eligible under Pereira.
Is the standard that the argument has to be absolutely foreclosed, or is the standard that it's pretty clear that the argument is a loser?
I think the standard is one of whether there is authority that is on point to render the argument. There was no authority in the wake of Pereira to argue that a subsequent notice of hearing, in fact, didn't stop the clock. And in some circuits, that's not true. And now the board has held that that is
true. Counsel, I don't know if that can be true. I think it's just as a descriptive matter, a lot of people were making that argument after Pereira, including obviously the folks in Lopez, right? Like, I think, so there was they were using Pereira. So I was curious the answer. I think Judge Fletcher said it really well. What is the standard? But if the standard is the way that you just articulated, that if there's authority on point that can be used to press the argument, I'm not sure that helps you because Pereira certainly was used to press that argument.
Well, it was used to press that argument. I agree, Your Honor. I don't believe that Pereira said anywhere in it that a notice of hearing subsequent to the putative NTA cures it. That just wasn't said, and that was the issue in this case.
Why didn't Pereira put you on notice that such an argument ought to be made? I mean, it seemed very plausible. If that was disruptive, we created a lot of uncertainty in the immigration bar community. There certainly were lawyers who were making the argument. We saw lots of these cases come through. You surely were on notice that there was there were some tremors in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, and that there might be further developments. Why aren't you responsible for developing those?
Well, I agree that there were some tremors, but I don't think there was anything on point that said he had the ability to still seek cancellation of removal until Lopez came down. There just simply wasn't a decision that said that was true in the circuit. And so for that reason, I don't believe he had an opportunity or obligation to address that argument until the Lopez case was promulgated, and did at that point.
And at what point does Ferreira come down in this narrative? My impression is that Ferreira comes down in a sense, if Ferreira is the case that gives him notice that there's an argument to be made here, it doesn't give him much time because it comes down at such a point that, you know, you've got to be awfully fast to figure out that you've got an argument under Ferreira. So could you help review the timeline for me?
Well, I can somewhat, yes. The Ferreira case came down, I believe, in 2000. Well, I don't have it in front of me, actually. I think it was 2017, perhaps 18. And there was some time in between it and the next decision, which was a board decision called Bermudez. And that case held that the notice of hearing didn't, in fact, cure it. So there was a back and forth tug of war that really still exists to this day. I know that Ms. Chavez has settled those questions, but there's still there's still some uncertainty in the air about what Pereira
stood for.
Counsel,
I think I understood Judge Fletcher's question to be more Pereira. What was the timing of that vis-a-vis where you were at, where your client was at in his proceedings before the BIA or the IJ, et cetera? Because did your client, I thought I understood Pereira actually came down after the BIA issued its decision in this case.
Yeah, that is correct, Your Honor. And a motion to reconsider was filed in a timely manner based on Pereira, but it was denied because in that motion, we argued the jurisdictional aspect of it, and that was rejected and has been rejected ever since.
What is your view? Do you have an obligation? So if Pereira came down afterwards, even assuming, for the sake of argument, I know you don't agree with this, that Pereira put you on notice, and so you had an obligation, what is your argument as far as the timing of Pereira? Like, do you have an obligation to file a notice to reopen or waive the issue, you know, or do you not have an obligation in order to preserve the issue on appeal?
So I think the operative court here is a much different dynamic than normal. The immigration court doesn't enjoy powers of equity. The immigration court is a creature of statute only. And so unless there's precedent directly on point, the immigration court isn't going to field those arguments. They're just not. I made them dozens of times, if not
I
more.
I think I'm asking a slightly different question, which, let's assume for a second that the immigration court would hear that argument and would have agreed with you, which obviously it wouldn't have because we know that later on it issued the decision that it issued before Lopez that went the other way. But let's assume it would have or may have. Do you have an obligation? Does your client have an obligation to file a motion to reopen to raise this new authority after basically proceedings are done in order to not essentially waive the issue before us?
No, Your Honor, because the Alcarez decision points out that motions to reopen are a creature of regulation and not of statute. They are not of right. They're discretionary, and therefore they don't obviate jurisdiction if they're not brought in the first instance. Prudential exhaustion also shouldn't apply because any motion to reopen would have been out of time relative to the regulation. So it would have been denied based on it being out of time.
Well, it would have been, you have like what, you have a certain amount of time, I'm trying to remember how long it is, but there's an exception to that for changes in new authority, right?
Well, no, that's not clear at all, Your Honor. I think that there are exceptions for changed country conditions, that's why that avenue exists for changes of regime, et cetera. But changes in the law aren't something the IJ or the board are obligated to acknowledge, I don't believe.
Counsel, just help me with the
not out of time anyway.
I'll ask the presiding judge to give you additional time to answer my question, please. So the IJ's decision comes down in July of 2017. The BIA's decision is issued on June 4th, 2018, and Pereira comes down 2 weeks later. Am I correct on that? June 21st, 2018?
That sounds about correct, yes.
So the only thing, in if Pereira signaled a change in the law for which you should have been more aggressive in your, you would have had to have asked the BIA for to reconsider or for a motion to reopen. Is that correct?
Well, we did ask for, that is correct, and we did ask for a motion to, we approached the board with a motion to reconsider. The argument that was made wasn't the ultimate argument that prevailed over the course of the litigation culminating with Lopez, though. And so that argument was that the IJ lacked jurisdiction because of the putative NTA, and that was rejected and has been rejected roundly ever since then. So we did make the Pereira argument. We didn't make the nuanced argument that eventually emerged via Lopez.
Yeah, so So I guess that raises another, and don't worry, we'll make sure you have time for rebuttal. So, but it does raise like a sort of another level of complexity to this case, in that assuming that you did not have an obligation to raise new authority in a motion to reopen, you just don't have that obligation, right? Let's assume that for a second. And and here the new authority, if Prairie was new authority, it did come down within the period of time you could have raised it. What makes this even a little more complicated is you did actually raise Prairie in a motion to reopen. You just didn't make the right argument, kind of as you just said. So, well, how does that affect? Like, let's just say you did not have an obligation to raise it because you don't have an obligation to raise it in the motion to reopen. But if you do bring a motion to reopen and you do raise it, but you don't make an argument, have you then waived it because you went ahead and did it, but you didn't do it very well?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that it's not waived because of the inherent complexity of the issues involved in Pereira and ultimately in Lopez. There's been decisions all over the board, from the Board of Immigration Appeals to many different courts of appeals, and I don't think it was ever waived. It certainly wasn't prejudicial to the government. They were on this issue as much as anybody from the publishing of Pereira. They knew that this notice of hearing didn't cure it in this particular case, and so there certainly wasn't any prejudice. And at the end of the day, this applicant is going to be potentially ineligible for cancellation of removal for no reason other than the randomness of geography. Because had he been in New York, Chicago, Miami, LA, or any other large city, it would have never made it to the end of his individual hearing until we had the decision in Lopez. And so randomness like that cries out for a remedy, and that remedy is a remand.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and move the government. We'll put a minute and a half back on the clock for rebuttal, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Roberta Roberts on behalf of the United States Attorney General. Your Honors, I'd like to first provide you with a timeline here in this case that would be relevant to the issue of bringing the argument based on Pereira. So the board's decision was issued on June 4th, 2018. Pereira v. Sessions was issued on June 21st, 2018. Petitioner filed his motion to reconsider and terminate, claiming lack of jurisdiction based on Pereira, on August 6th, 2018. Now, matter of Bermudez-Cotes, which addressed jurisdiction, that was decided after the petitioner filed his motion to reconsider. And matter of Mendoza-Hernandez, which specifically addressed whether the stop time bar applies, that board decision was issued on May 1st, 2019. That would be the decision that would have foreclosed petitioner's argument to the board about whether he would have been eligible to apply for cancellation of removal. That decision did not come until 2019. When petitioner filed his motion to reconsider and terminate based on Pereira in August of 2018, he had the opportunity to make the argument that the stop time bar would not have stopped accrual of his continuous physical presence,
counsel, I think we're pretty familiar with the timeline. So I get this kind of goes back to I think a question that Judge Fletcher asked your counsel on the other side, which is, so what is your position as far as what the standard is? Obviously, there's a standard that it has to be a case like Lopez that makes abundantly clear that you can do it, that you have this argument. Does it have to just barely have cracked open the door for the possibility of making an argument? What is the government's position as far as what the standard that we would apply to say, well, the argument was available to you and you should have made it?
Your Honor.
Is it the cracked door? I assumed you're going to say the cracked door.
Yes, Your Honor. We would say it is the cracked door because the Ninth Circuit, this court has said that the exception to the prudential exhaustion requirement, it's only when it would be futile to raise the argument.
As a practical matter, it kind of was futile. Like, we know that if he'd raised it before the BIA, the BIA would have said no. It did so the following May in Mendoza-Hernandez, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But however, that was not said until after the motion was filed. Mendoza-Hernandez did not come out until 2019. Prior to that time, the board was not bound by prior precedent that would have precluded it from granting relief, which is the standard that is stated in Alvarado v. Holder, Your Honor.
Now, you know, in the circumstances of this case, this is an awfully demanding standard. I think really an unrealistically demanding standard. If you're just talking about ordinary human behavior, competent lawyer behavior, you're asking his lawyer to beat their head against the wall, and you say, well, because you didn't beat your head against the wall, you lose. I understand beat your head against the wall is not a very precise standard.
No, Your Honor, but that is not the standard here, especially where the precise issue that petitioner is asking for remand for about in terms of the stop time rule and physical presence accruing, that is the exact narrow issue that was addressed in Pereira. So petitioner...
But, well, it was addressed in Pereira, but without talking about what's possible for curative. Correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you please repeat that?
The issue addressed in Pereira did not include what happens or how you can cure that with a subsequent notice, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. That's not handled until 2021 in Ms. Chavez.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, counsel, are there any cases in which that you're aware of in which we or any other court has said this issue does not have to be exhausted in order to be preserved?
Your Honor, not that I am aware of, Your Honor. As mentioned, there is an exception to the prudential exhaustion requirement where it would be futile. However, that does not seem to be the case here, Your Honor.
I have an unpublished opinion from 2021 from our court in which we said that it did not have to exhaust. It appears that his dates are a little bit earlier, so it appears to be pre-Pereira. But why would that make a difference? We said he was not required to exhaust the question.
Your Honor, I may not be familiar with this unpublished decision you mentioned, Your Honor. Could you please repeat the question?
Yeah. In this case, it appears that the proceedings terminated before Pereira, and we said that that Ms. Chavez really was the governing standard and that he was not required to exhaust. So, I mean, the question I think that's raised by a decision like that, somewhat distinguishable from this one, is why couldn't the government come in and argue that you're responsible to anticipate Pereira, much less wait for Pereira and then try to develop it further?
Yes, Your Honor. There is an unpublished decision. It may or may not be the one that you are referencing. And in that case, the petitioner there was in cancellation of removal, had already applied for cancellation of removal for lawful permanent resident, or that is the form of cancellation they wanted to seek. And Pereira, they were in removal proceedings between 2012 to 2014. So they were just...
So are you looking at Cobian versus Garland?
Yes, Your Honor. That's
the case that I've seen. But why in that case weren't they responsible for anticipating Pereira? I mean, you've argued here that they're responsible basically for anticipating Ms. Chavez.
Yes, Your Honor, but here in this case, the court's indulgence, if I may just briefly refer to this case.
We wrote, although he did not seek such relief from the IJ or BIA, administrative and prudential exhaustion are not required for this issue because cancellation of removal was so entirely foreclosed to Cáceres-Cobian during his immigration proceedings that resort to the agency would have been futile. And cancellation of removal law has changed, and NTA must contain the time, date, and place of a non-citizen's removal hearing to trigger the stop time rule, citing Ms. Chavez.
Yes, Your Honor. The difference between that case and here is that here in this case, the petitioner already took the steps of filing a motion to reconsider based on Pereira.
But was it untimely? Was the motion to reconsider untimely?
It was, Your Honor.
So, you know, sort of like he didn't do it timely. So in theory, it could have just not even. It's almost like he didn't file it. So there are some mistakes made, but is that your way of distinguishing? Is you think that I want to follow that a little bit. We're going to run low on time. Because that I think is a pretty important issue in this case, and that is, do you have any cases to support the idea that you have to exhaust if a decision comes out afterwards that cracks open the door, the requisite amount, whatever amount is necessary, that you have to file a motion to reconsider or a motion to reopen in order to raise the issue in your petition before us? Are there any cases about that?
No, Your Honor, but the current case law that the Ninth Circuit has, for example, in Alvarado v. Holder, that the exception to the prudential exhaustion requirement applies when the board is bound by prior precedent and the petition, the board would be precluded from granting relief in that case. But here, the board would not have been granted from, would not have been precluded from granting relief.
Well, when it issued its decision, it was, right? You agree with that. When it actually issued the decision that we're reviewing, it was precluded because there was board precedent from 2011 that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, at the
okay,
time.
Okay, so your position, it's a little bit of a circular argument because you're basically saying they weren't precluded after they issued decision, so therefore you have to file a motion to reopen. But I'm not sure, you know, when we said that the exception would be if the board was precluded, that we were implicitly saying, and that means you have to file a motion to reopen or motion of reconsideration if it changes after the fact. I don't think we've addressed that issue before, I don't think, unless there's some decision out there I'm not aware of. And I'm asking you if you're aware of any.
Your Honor, I am not. This appears to be an issue of first impression, Your Honor. Also, I see that my time is...
No, I know, but I'll give you more. Because this is really actually kind of the fundamental issue in this case, I think, is did he have a responsibility to raise it after the fact if it comes up? And if he did not have a responsibility, but then he went ahead and tried to raise it, you know, he raised a Pereira issue but raised the wrong issue, does that somehow change the equation? That to me seems to be pretty important to this case. We haven't really talked about that with you so far, but I think you're acknowledging that we don't really have on-point precedent for that first question, is whether he has to raise it, whether he has an obligation to raise it if something happens after that cracks the door open after the board issues its decision. There's no case you can point to that says he has to raise it.
No, Your Honor.
And then the question becomes, if he does raise it, but raises it wrong, has he somehow waived it because he made a Pereira argument but didn't make the right one? And I don't know. I guess we'll have to. You're not aware of any precedent on that either.
No, Your Honor. But it does seem relevant that Alcaraz does mention that even if jurisdiction is not precluded by the statute, exhaustion of administrative remedies by a motion to reopen may be required as a matter of prudence in order to develop a proper record, prevent deliberate bypass of the administrative scheme, and allow the agency to correct its own mistakes.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it was a mistake at the time that the agency made it. I think the agency was following a permissible view of the law.
You're correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, I don't think it was a mistake.
Yeah, I think maybe what if Judge Fletcher may begin as like, you know, that rationale of saying let the agency have a bite at it first, especially at this point where all that's kind of water under the bridge with the very, you know, with Lopez and then Nishevez, it certainly doesn't apply in this case at all. But secondly, I mean, we do know what the agency would have done. It wouldn't have corrected its own mistake and issued a Nishevez type decision. It would have did what it did in Mendoza-Hernandez. So, and then finally, I think Judge Fletcher's earlier comment about the fact that, I mean, even if you assume that he had some sort of obligation, what it happened 2 weeks after, or he has a month to, you know, that means he has to figure this out in what remains of his month, in that short period of time, which he did not do, because he filed his, he actually did file something about Prairie, but it was a month late. So that is asking a lot. That's asking a lot of a petitioner. If we created a rule that said you got to raise it within the period of time on a motion for reconsideration, which I think we would be creating. I think you can see that. We would be making new law on that if we decided that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I do see that. And yes, there's 30 days to file the motion to reconsider and 90 days to file the motion to reopen.
Yeah, and he filed a motion to reconsider like a month and some change late, right? And all right. Well, I think, if my colleagues, do you have any additional questions at all? So we'll go ahead and we'll let counsel for petitioner, you have a minute and a half for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. Two things jump out at me from this discussion. The first is that the agency was following the law back then, and it was, because that was the law until, well, Lopez in the Ninth Circuit and then Ms. Chavez from the Supreme Court. So we absolutely know what the agency would have done with that request. There's no doubt about it. And it would have denied it. And they did deny these motions systematically until they were told they couldn't. And so the idea that we could have had some administrative meaningful look at this case before raising the issue here, I believe is fictional. We would have had no such look at it. The agency is a creature of statute. It would have followed its own precedent. It's not going to forge ahead down new roads. That wasn't going to happen until it was told to do so. And I appreciate all of your attention and time today.
Thank you, counsel. Any further questions from my colleagues? All right. Well, thank you to both of you. It's been it's got some little challenging issues in this case, and thank you both for helping us think about it. With that, this case is submitted, and we'll be moving on to the next case.